Joining me today is a writer, an activist, and the founder of TheoryOfEnchantment.com, Chloe Valdery. Welcome to the Rubin Report.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very happy to have you here because you are one of, I don't know, I'd say 12 people online that don't make me completely insane. Like, I look at your Twitter feed and I'm like, oh, there's someone with a brain that's actually not completely insane.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's the highest compliment I can give anybody.
I try.
So actually, we met a couple months ago in September at a Jordan Peterson event.
Yes.
Would you say that was the best white supremacist event you were ever at?
Excellent. I mean, I was terrified.
Yeah. Before we get into your history and everything else, and you're doing truly so much great work.
Thank you.
What do you make of the Peterson phenomenon? Because so many of my guests I'm finding are coming to shows, and it's like, it's pretty cool.
I understand Jordan Peterson, like, fundamentally. I understand what he's doing. I think that he is compelling to many people because in many cases, he's a storyteller. He's a great storyteller. And what he can do is he can distill lessons from stories. Stories found in pop culture, stories that are history and derive lessons that you can apply to your life. And I think that anyone who can do that will be compelling because they can actually better your life. And I think that's the secret as to why he's so popular. And also, I've noticed that he's becoming more mainstream. Mm-hmm. Like, he's becoming more acceptable in mainstream society, which is a positive trend. Like, seeing him being interviewed on Dr. Oz, for example, was like a moment, I think, of him inching closer and closer to the mainstream.
What's that phrase? First they ignore you, then they mock you, then they want to be you, something like that. So he may be in that version of it.
I think he's in that, yeah.
All right, well, speaking of stories, tell me a little bit about your story. Who the hell are you?
Oh, yes, I am Chloe. I'm from New Orleans originally, born and raised. My story, I guess, is an interesting one. I was born and raised in a very atypical Christian family. Atypical in the sense that I grew up as a Christian observing Shabbat.
Yeah, so what is that? What is that?
So the way I like to tell it is, you know, have you heard of Seventh-day Adventists?
I have.
So it's like Seventh-day Adventists, but on steroids. Essentially, that's how I grew up. So Seventh-day Adventists, to my understanding, they keep Shabbat. That's why they call them the seventh day. So they go to church on Saturday instead of Sunday. So we did that also, but we also did things like we observed Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. And all the Jewish holy days, and we also kept kosher style, so I don't eat pork or shellfish. And that was an interesting upbringing. I have two funny stories to tell you. The first is about Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
So, as I'm sure you know, in the Jewish tradition.
I've done it once or twice.
Right.
Yeah.
So, can you tell me what age one begins fasting for Yom Kippur?
Well, there's an obvious answer here that obviously can't be the right answer, but I would assume 13.
No, that's the right answer.
Oh, okay.
That's the right answer. Yeah.
So you're pulling a little trickery on me.
No.
Okay.
That's the right answer.
Okay.
Like bat mitzvah.
Okay.
Right? My parents didn't have the rabbinical text to advise them on like what age they should make their kids start fasting. And so for some reason they decided that 5 years old would be a good time to. So I've been fasting for Yom Kippur since I was 5.
Oh, man.
So. Yeah.
So you're an old pro now.
Yes. Yeah. So that's like one quick story of how I grew up. And then my father introduced me to the writings of Leon Uris when I was 15 years old. So he was a really famous Jewish author who wrote a lot about the reestablishment of the State of Israel. He wrote books like Exodus and QV7 and Mila 18. And I read all these books throughout high school and was part of the Hebrew Culture Club in high school, went to a very egalitarian high school in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So this is sort of my introduction to the world of Jewish culture, but also Israel in a contemporary sense.
Yeah.
And then I attended the University of New Orleans, where I initially majored in film, but then switched majors to international studies in 2012.
Graduated magna cum laude.
Yes. I had to think about it.
Yeah.
Yes. But the reason why I switched majors was because anti-Semitism was resurfacing in Europe.
This episode of the Rubin Report comes to you with support from our friends over at Bravo Company Manufacturing. In the Second Amendment, the Founding Fathers guaranteed an individual the right to protect themselves. Owning a rifle is an awesome responsibility, and building rifles is no different. Started in a garage by a Marine veteran more than two decades ago, Bravo Company Manufacturing, or BCM for short, builds a professional-grade product which is built to combat standards. This is because BCM believes that the same level of protection should be provided to to every American, regardless if they're a private citizen or a professional. Bravo Company Manufacturing is not a sporting arms company. They design, engineer, and manufacture life-saving equipment. BCM assumes that when a rifle leaves their shop, it'll be used in a life-or-death situation by a responsible citizen, law enforcement officer, or a soldier overseas, so quality is of utmost value to them. Every component of a BCM rifle is hand-assembled and tested by Americans in Heartland, Wisconsin, to a life-saving standard. BCM always puts people before products. They build their products because they feel it's their moral responsibility as Americans to provide tools that will not fail the end user when it's not just a paper target, but someone coming to do them harm. Because of this, BCM knows that making reliable, life-saving tools is only half the story. They also work with leading instructors of marksmanship from top levels of America's Special Operations Forces. To learn more about Bravo Company Manufacturing, head over to BravoCompanyMFG.com, where you can discover more about their products, special offers, and upcoming news. That's BravoCompanyMFG.com. Need more convincing? Find out even more about BCM and the awesome people who make their products at youtube.com/BravoCompanyUSA. And now back to the show.
In France in particular.
Yeah. So this is about, what, 7, 8 years ago?
This
is
2012.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, and I wanted to get involved in the Israel space. So that's why I switched majors, and I started a student pro-Israel organization on campus. Did Israel advocacy for 3.5 years. Realized that we didn't know what we were doing, but I learned a lot from that experience. Mm-hmm. And that was my college experience.
Yeah, okay, so we're gonna get to obviously a lot of the advocacy work that you do and some of the things that you've written and all that, but just a little bit more on the growing up part, because there's something really fascinating there. It's like, it's sort of, for you, it's like, oh, well, this is how I grew up. It kind of is what it is, but it sounds, for other people, it's like, wait a minute, so she's Christian, but was celebrating all these Jewish holidays. Yeah. Like. How was that explained to you as a child, or was it explained to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was like the explanation was, this is how Jesus and the disciples observed, so we're gonna observe in this way. That was like the basic explanation, and then like just growing up, you know, you're conditioned to do these things, and so it just becomes rote and becomes like basic. But like you're saying, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people looking from the outside in. So
yeah. Okay, so college, you started realizing that. The things that you had grown up around, that something was sort of under assault, sort of.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
I think that because, you know, anti-Semitism is fundamentally like dehumanization of Jews, and because I had grown up with such a, not just a, like a love for the Jewish people, but an awareness of Jewish culture, like to a certain extent, my identity was defined by Jewish culture or adjacent to Jewish culture. So I think in that sense, it did feel like something, a part of me was under attack. So that was probably a huge catalyst for getting involved.
What did your Jewish friends think about this girl that, you know, doesn't stereotypically look Jewish, which is a ridiculous thing to say, of course, because there are Black Jews and Latino Jews and Chinese Jews and everything else.
Right.
Did your friends think like, what is this thing?
In college, you mean?
College, growing up, whatever it is.
Well, growing up, I don't know if they thought any different. I don't remember. I just remember that the Jewish kids and myself were not in school during Rosh Hashanah. we were just absent at the same time.
Yeah.
In college, I just made all my friends.
Pretty good if you want a couple extra days off.
Very good. Very good. I mean, I didn't even talk about Sukkot. That's a whole other story. But in college, I just made my friends join my club. So they, like, I just made them, like, there was no, like, oh, this is, it was just who I was and, like, a part of, you know, my life.
So. Yeah. So it seems to me that right now, I guess, campus anti-Semitism is sort of running rampant. I think it has a lot to do with BDS, and we can talk about that and more. But what were you actually seeing back then that were the markers?
Yeah. I mean, back then, so there wasn't, like, systemic anti-Semitism at the University of New Orleans. Or, for example, at Tulane, where I did a lot of pro-Israel stuff also. But actually what I discovered was, though there was anti-Semitism on certain campuses, certain hotbed campuses like Columbia and UC Irvine, and we've heard about all of these different campuses where there are, you know, problems, the larger issue was that we in the community were confusing two different things. We were confusing two very important questions with each other. The first question was, how do you combat anti-Semitism, which is a noble question, a good question, a question that got me involved, with the question of how do you actually get people to fall in love with Israelis? And we were confusing those two questions, and as a result, we were shaping the basis of our advocacy around the wrong assumptions. So, like, the first question, how do you fight anti-Semitism, is essentially a question of how do you get people to stop hating? Mm-hmm. But the second question, how do you get people to fall in love with Israelis or Israeli society, is a question of how do you get people to start loving, mm-hmm. which is a totally different question. And I say, like, collectively, we, the pro-Israel community in America, hadn't figured that out. And so, as a result, we were doing pro-Israel advocacy, where we were putting together projects within the realm of pro-Israel advocacy that didn't make sense.
Yeah.
And that was the larger trend that I observed, that I witnessed when I was in college.
All right, so let's do both of those. So first, yeah. How do you deal with disassembling anti-Semitism, or just hatred in general?
Yeah. Well, I think they're interconnected on some level. I think it's not just enough to continue to tell people to stop hating. Obviously, that's important, but you also have to create a framework and create sort of like a collection of lessons, if you will, on how to start loving, on how to love, if you will. I think that actually ends up combating anti-Semitism and combating all forms of hatred if you actually build out a framework or try to teach people how to love.
Do you think there's something unique about hating Jews that's a little bit different than hating other people, like sort of partly a historical reason, because it goes back forever, basically,
right. But
also that I find right now, I mean, most of the people that hate me are on the left, let's say.
Right.
So I get a relentless amount of hate from them, and I don't get a lot of hate from the right, but every now and again when I get a hatred from the right, it's, you Jew, blah, blah,
right.
blah, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
In my case, it's very disproportionate on one side, and
right.
that probably has more to do with my politics than
right.
anything else. But I do think it's interesting that it is that horseshoe theory where the
right.
people on the fringes both end up hating you for identity.
Right. That's a good question. Do I think anti-Semitism is, like, uniquely a problem or uniquely different? I mean, if you were to look at intersectionality, for example, which is this...
I was hoping we'd get to it. Yeah.
My favorite topic.
Yeah, let's do it. Can you explain, let's steel man intersectionality. Can you give me what the person out there that's the believer in
right.
intersectionality, what would they
point.
Tell you intersectionality is before we knock it down?
Here? Right. I think I can steel man it. I mean, I'd say that intersectionality makes three claims, one of which is true. The first claim that it makes is that you can experience intersecting forms of oppression. So I, as both a woman and a person of color, can experience forms of oppression by virtues of those categories to which I belong, and they can intersect and interact with each other in new ways. And I think that's
for the record, I've been conducting this interview as if you were a white man.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to be clear because I'm trying not to.
Thank you so much. Such a relief.
Right. Okay, but you've got these two immutable characteristics, basically,
right,
that
right.
could intertwine based in their outsider characteristics.
Right,
I'd say.
Right. So, like, a person, a man could be sexist toward me, or a white person could be racist toward me, right? And then both of those types of discriminations or prejudices can interact in different ways, which I think is a basically true statement, right?
Okay.
So that is the extent to which I can steal man intersectionality.
Okay, now give me the knot.
Right. The not so true, and actually I would say dangerously false, claims of intersectionality. One is that the primary motivator behind all human interaction is power.
Mm-hmm.
And by power, they mean like the power in order to oppress. So I could be having a political disagreement with you in good faith, but according to the intersectionalists, it doesn't matter because you have white skin and I have brown skin, and so you, by virtue of the category that you exist in, you are trying to oppress me.
Right, and in this case, my gayness would fall below the importance
right.
of, say, my white skin.
Exactly.
And intersection on the scale of intersectionality,
right.
Jewishness is completely sort of thrown
right.
out, which
right.
I think is related to the Israel thing, which we'll
yeah,
obviously talk about.
Definitely, like hierarchies of what, like virtues and stuff like that, or lack thereof in your case.
Yeah. I'm just me, what can I tell you?
So that's the first dangerous claim that it makes, and then the second conclusion, I guess you would say, to which it comes, is a conclusion of racial essentialism. So what that means is you could take any human, basic human behavior, let's say feeling entitled, right? So my friend could have a new iPhone X, and for some reason, like, I don't have the money to buy the iPhone X, but I want the iPhone X, whatever. I'm coveting, right,
yeah,
this iPhone X, if you will. So I feel a sense of entitlement to it, right? So any human being can feel a sense of entitlement, right? That's my point. But the intersectionalists will claim that entitlement, like, a priori, is the white man's thing. So they will refer to entitlement as white male entitlement, as if the only type of human being that can feel or express a behavior of entitlement is a white male. And so in doing that, they are racially essentializing people. They are taking human behaviors and turning them into essential characteristics of people that belong to one category.
So as somebody that comes from a unique religious perspective,
yes,
what do you make of the religious nature of the people that buy into this ideology?
It's a good question. I mean, it's like many religions, it is all-encompassing. Certainly like certain, I would say, mainstream forms of Christianity, it sort of preaches this born-again type mentality where you become woke, right? Mm. Which is just another word for enlightened, right? Yeah. That's what they mean.
You can say
it.
Annoying, but okay.
No, but like the yeah, parallels are like you've become, well, you've become,
right,
born again, you've become. The problem, well, one of the many problems is that there's no salvation, there's no redemption in this religion. You get brownie points or virtue points if you are, if you belong to certain categories, like if you're a person of color, if you're a woman, etc. And you get less points if you're white, if you're male, if you're straight, etc., etc. And what this does is it has a caricaturing effect on human beings, where people are reduced to caricatures. It creates this effect where the people who are intersectionalists and who believe in this theory are sort of incapable of dealing with nuance and dealing with depth and human complexity, which is sad, not just for the people that they're attacking, but for themselves.
Do you think it's an overstep to call it the new type of racism? Because I'm really coming around,
yeah,
to that.
You're
belief.
Like edging very close.
Yeah, like I'm like right there on that. I've said it once or twice. I don't really like saying it because,
yeah,
I don't want to start using the tactics,
right,
which I hate so much, right? Of
right,
course
right,
I don't
right.
want to do that. But I don't know if you saw my episode with her in August. I had Catherine Birbal Singh, who's a wonderful teacher at Michaela School in the UK.
Okay.
And she flat out, and she's of brown skin and
yeah.
the whole thing,
yeah,
but she doesn't buy into any of this nonsense. And she was adamant in saying, this is the new racism and we must call it that.
Mm.
And I agree with the heart of the sentiment,
right,
and
right.
I just adore her, and I spoke at school a couple weeks ago, but I'm a little leery of—
Why are you leery of it?
Because I don't want to fall into the same trap that they've come in, where every time I hear one of their arguments, the idea would be that I could just turn to them and be like, well, you're the new racist. You know what I mean? Where, because it's just, right, and shut it down.
Yeah,
it's so easy and lazy and the rest of it. So I don't want to do that. And yet, if I see the way the world is now, where I see true racism coming from, it's almost exclusively coming from these people. I'm not saying that there aren't some white nationalists.
Right, right.
There are some. They have no power.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about them. They're mocked, and they're actually propped up by the media to make it seem like they're running the world.
Yeah.
But where I see true racism coming from these days, and a true hatred based on immutable characteristics, is this set of intersectional woke people. I just don't want to be that.
Right, right. That's a very good and deep question. I think that for my purposes, I don't just want to, like, I want to criticize in a meaningful way. So I would have to ask the question, will I get people who believe in intersectionalist theory to change or convince them to change simply by calling them racist? Probably not.
Probably not. And right, and it's not when they call all these people on the right, they call basic conservatives or libertarians racist.
Right.
It's not like they're coming around.
Right,
so
it's not like they're like, oh yes, you're right, I should just be an intersectionalist. I am woke. I am now born again. No, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I think I would rather challenge people who believe in this theory on their own terms.
Do you get a unique cred to do that because of your...
Of
so how does that work that you can almost use their own crappy thing against right. them in a bizarre way, even though you don't believe in it. There's a unique power there, I suppose.
I think what I do is I convey depth, meaning I think I am an example of human complexity. So on the surface level, I am using their own hierarchy of virtuous people or virtuous types against them. But at the same time, I think I'm showing them that human complexity actually exists because I disagree with them. So it's like a cognitive dissonance thing that they have to figure out. But I'm more interested in trying to challenge people who believe in this, especially young people, let's say, because on the college campuses and such, to become better people. And I have to, in order to do that, I have to criticize them in a way that actually speaks to their potential to be better people. I mean, I'm not going to accomplish that by calling them racist. But what I can do is try to, for example, point them to, I think, authors and people in literature, for example, who they highly esteem, whose work they don't quite yet realize is not intersectional. Mm-hmm.
So who might that be, perhaps?
Maya Angelou, for example. I think that there is a very stark contrast between, like, Ta-Nehisi Coates and Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. The very first poet I was forced to memorize as a child was Maya Angelou. And so, like, I feel like I carry her spirit with me. And the way she talks about human complexity and the way she talks about how nobling the human spirit is in many ways a contrast to intersectionalist theory. She famously one time said that Shakespeare must have been a black woman because one of his sonnets she felt so closely and intimately connected to in the struggles that she was going through as a child. And her point was that all of this literature, even if it comes from, like, let's say the dead white male, right, was written for all of you, for each of you, and you can see yourself in the stories that these great writers created, and that's the point, that's what makes them great writers, is the fact that you can see yourself in them. So I would point people toward especially her work because they typically and generally esteem her and they consider her to be an icon, and I think she was an icon, but then I can use that to actually teach them, well, here's an alternative way of thinking, actually, and what you're learning in your post-structuralist class about, like, human life and human affairs isn't necessarily true, and it isn't the only thing out there.
If you like supporting small businesses and unique products, then let me tell you about a company that'll embrace you as much as you embrace them. Datsusara is a small business that makes an innovative line of bags, clothing, and accessories from hemp fabrics. Their name comes from a Japanese phrase that embodies the spirit of freeing yourself to find your true path. Their backpacks will fit all your needs with highly functional styles and naturally antimicrobial, breathable hemp fabric that won't get nasty or moldy. Datsusara bags are not your typical hippie hemp gear. Lesser bags break, a Datsusara bag comes with a 3-year warranty. You'll find a wide variety of products from bags, clothing, and accessories for your whole family. Datsusara truly cares about your path, free speech, and the pursuit of the best ideas to benefit all, which is exactly why they support the Rubin Report. Head over to dsgear.com and use the promo code Rubin for 10% off any order. That's dsgear.com and use the promo code Rubin for 10% off any order. And now back to the show. What do you make of the fact that it seems like so many young people are going to college so ill-prepared to deal with the world as it is that they become so religious in nature when it comes to this stuff? Like, if they had been given better tools, perhaps some of the things that Jordan Peterson's talking about, that they could go into school and be challenged and be okay with it as opposed to going in and converting, seemingly.
Right. I guess that's a parent problem on some level.
It's a parent and a parent,
I mean, I think it's a question of upbringing, obviously. But I also think, I think that maybe it signifies that students are searching for meaning. I mean, students are searching for meaning. I was searching for meaning in college, you know. We're searching for meaning all of our lives, right? And then what does it say that the only thing that's seemingly out there that's giving them meaning, at least within the college context, is intersectionalist theory? I mean, like, surely we as a society can do better than that. But I think that Jordan Peterson represents this contrast because he is getting a lot of fame and popular. He is considered to be popular among some people, many people in college probably. So I think that in that sense, maybe they're not being as converted as much as it seems they are.
Yeah.
Maybe there is a battle of ideas of the hearts and minds of these students. So
yeah.
That's a good thing.
Well, there's definitely statistical evidence that that's true, right? There was that study that came out a couple months ago that basically only 8% of young people actually are these hysterical, shrieking intersectionalists.
Right.
But because they're so loud, they're just silencing the majority. So that's encouraging.
Well, that means it's our fault because
right. Well, that's what I always say. People, every event
so
I go to,
they're not being loud enough, really.
Well, that's the funny thing. It's like literally every event I go to, from the Peterson event that you were at in Long Island to when I do stand-up gigs, whatever it is, people come up to me after and they go, "What can I do? What can I do?"
Right.
And the only thing that I can come up with that has any meaning whatsoever is start speaking.
Right.
Like, you live in the freest society in the history of the world, and you're afraid to say what you think.
Yeah, and also,
how would you be in one of the bad places?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and also, like, with social media, we all have our own media companies now. Like, anything is possible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we need to start speaking more, but I also think we need to, like I said earlier, we need to emphasize, like, it's not enough to tell people how to stop hating. We also have to teach them how to start loving, and I think that that's something that needs to be developed further also.
All right, so let's put the start loving part on hold for a minute, because that seems like a good ending point for me. So let's put that to the end, okay?
Yeah.
I've noticed you've been pretty critical about what's going on in the Women's March, and I think we're starting to see, which I think is positive, that this intersectional sort of hierarchy or monster, I think is a better word, that it can't hold very long. And I think we're seeing the evidence of that now. Can you explain a little bit of why that is?
Have you seen the article that came out yesterday in Tablet about the Women's March?
I've had a crazy couple days here. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So all this time, you know, we had this suspicion that the leaders in the Women's March, including Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and Carmen Perez, were sort of like pretty, like, anti-Semitic, like, hubnubbing with Farrakhan and posting very positive remarks about Farrakhan on their social media platforms. And
right. When you say we, you mean, like, us and the other, the sort of...
Sorry, yes, I should clarify.
Whatever you want to call that subset of people,
not
what mainstream portrays them to be.
Sure, but I'd say that this has been a concern in the Jewish community by and large for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the majority of Jews in this country are pro-Israel, right? And so collectively, the pro-Israel community has had a creeping suspicion about these women's intentions when they came to allowing Jews to march, or like telling Jews to have a safe place to march, or even a space to march. And the Women's March, and I'm actually part of a organization called Zioness, which tries to give a space to progressive Jewish women to march in these women's marches, even though Linda Sarsour is shouting at them, there's no room for you here, right?
Yeah.
So the idea is like, oh, you're not going to give us a table, we'll build our own table. But what's interesting is that yesterday this bombshell report came out in Tablet magazine, and our worst suspicions were confirmed.
I did see a little bit of this actually about the security and everything else. Yeah, so go ahead.
So apparently, I'll say allegedly, allegedly, at the very first meeting with these women who were being added to, as co-chairs to the Women's March, there were anti-Semitic statements made about Jews, and consistently throughout their time as co-chairs. They've allegedly been hiring security folks from the Nation of Islam, Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. For those of you who may be watching who don't know, Farrakhan has famously infamously referred to Jews as termites. I mean, he's a notorious anti-Semite.
Yeah.
So it turns out that
he's on Twitter, no problem.
Yeah. You can check him out if you want.
We'll link to his Twitter right down below.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So these women have been hiring security guards from the Nation of Islam to do their security detail at the Women's March. And so it's a really bombshell report. I encourage your viewers to read it, but...
Yeah, we actually will link to that down below.
Yeah.
Not to Farrakhan's Twitter,
right.
But we will put a link to the article down below.
Yeah. And it is like it's a crazy moment. So
does this seem like it obvious to you in a way? Like, it sort of seems obvious to me that 2-3 years ago there were a bunch of us, I think, sort of old school decent liberals that were like, this thing, this marriage in hell between the Women's March and Sarsour, like this thing can't hold. Of course this is going to happen.
Right.
So like, I think there's a little bit of like, I told you so here for
there,
some of us.
There
you
definitely
know?
Is. I mean, I posted this on my Facebook yesterday and I definitely got some of that. So, so.
But that doesn't make it feel any better, right?
Right.
Though it's not like you're like, ah, ha ha, see, I'm Nostradamus over here.
Right,
you know?
Right. I mean, I guess one just hopes that people who are leaders would have the integrity and responsibility and introspection to not do this.
So what do you think has to happen then for the Women's March to move forward with whatever the goodness of that is?
Right. I think, well, we, for example, I decided I'm not marching in the women in any march affiliated with the Women's March Inc., which mm-hmm. is the organization that those women sit on the board of. So I'm just not going to, and there are other marches, there are other individual marches that have actually cut ties with Women's March Inc. that people can still march with if they feel so inclined. But as far as that particular organization is concerned, I'm not marching with them anymore.
So is the inherent problem of sort of just collectivism as a ideology that to say a woman's march is inherently sort of ridiculous because...
Why so?
Well, because everyone's for women. It's a very, as Jordan would say, it's a low resolution argument. Everyone would say that you're for women, right? Like, no one's not for women or for women to be equal. Not nobody, but by and large, any sane member of society is not for women to be equal, in a Western society at least.
Yeah.
But when you say you're for women, what you're always going to do is exclude the minority women. So in this case, forget skin color even, although this is a minority skin color, I suppose. The Women's March organizers, they're not for Nikki Haley. They're not for a strong conservative woman who happens to have brown skin, but even forgetting her skin color. They're not for Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Right.
They're not for any woman that doesn't believe in the ideology. So you're saying you're for women. You mean that women who behave.
Right. That's an interesting retort. I think I slightly disagree with the, if you specify the demographic that you are marching on behalf, then you are necessarily not including other people in that category. It happens to be the case.
Well, I would say maybe it's de facto and maybe not intended. Like the function of it ultimately.
I don't think there's anything wrong with outlining like on whose behalf you're marching.
Mm-hmm.
I do take your point but I think that this has been true of women's marches, if you will, throughout the, like, since the suffrage movement. Like, even within the women's suffrage movement, there were a lot of tensions because, for example, who's the most famous one? Susan B. Anthony.
Yes.
Okay, so there was a dispute between Susan B. Anthony, if I have my facts correct. Fact check me on this one. There's a dispute between...
Oh, don't worry. This is YouTube. They'll fact check you. Don't worry.
There's a dispute between Susan B. Anthony and another woman, whose name, of course, I forget at this moment. And the reason was that Susan B. Anthony was actually willing to hobnob with people who are racist in order to get the vote passed. And this other woman who was one of the founders of the suffragist movement had this falling out with her because she was like, you cannot associate with, you know, these people who are trying to undermine another demographic in the country. And so I say all that to say that I think that there will always be these tensions within these mass movements, especially if you read this article that came out in Tablet Magazine, especially if you are rooted in an intersectionalist framework. I think that that's the issue. I think that you might be able to see Nikki Haley and some of the other women you mentioned if it wasn't actually rooted in intersectionality. On the other hand, the Women's March is a self-proclaimed progressive movement, and so by virtue of that, they're not going to include Republican women.
Right. So I guess that's it.
So the name is a bit of a misnomer.
So that's what it is, I think, because I would argue that being for progressivism as it stands in 2018 is not being for women.
Right.
So I guess it's a little bit of the.
That's fair. And so I think that if you were to come across a progressive march, like a decade ago,
yeah, sure,
it would look very different from how it looks now.
So that's actually a perfect segue. How is this all connected to whatever's going on with feminism right now, do you think?
Do you consider
yourself a feminist? I know it's a label that people are sort of scared of now. They either embrace it and they're not sure why, or they're very scared of it, or...
Yeah, I don't really have this, like, knee-jerk, viscerally, like, felt disgust toward the term feminism. I feel like many people, certainly on the right, are increasingly having that reaction, and I understand why. Like, if third wave feminism is rooted in intersectionality, then I believe in feminism as a basic like idea, you know. I love the work of Camille Paglia.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, I'm definitely
she's been fighting this for a long time.
But I think like basic, if you believe in like equality for women and basic egalitarianism, to the extent that that is feminism, I'm a feminist. I don't need to like adopt all the other frameworks that third wave feminism is adopting now to consider myself a feminist, I'd say.
Yeah, so let's just back up slightly to what you were saying about these competing sort of methods and how people do things. So Susan B. Anthony was willing to talk to some people.
Yeah.
This other woman wasn't. I mean, we've seen this in all sorts of movements.
Right.
Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Behaved a certain way, talked to certain people.
Yeah.
Malcolm X had a different view of it. So you view that as sort of a necessary sort of push and pull on how a movement is built?
Well, I think that whether I believe in it or not, that is how movements are built. I think especially if you look at the Martin Luther King versus Malcolm X dichotomy, it's much more interesting because I was actually just talking to a friend about this. I don't think people realize how difficult it was in the 60s to buy into and practice Dr. King's philosophy. Like, we take it for granted in 2018.
Even though a lot of people don't do it now, in a weird way, right?
Yes, but I think that makes sense because we're ironically privileged. I think that makes perfect sense.
That's a good title for a book.
Ironically privileged. But people don't realize that these guys were training themselves not to fight back when they were having, you know, like condiments poured on them in diners. Like, that's hard. And to root your belief in the idea that I am not going to fight back because these white people were made in the image of God is a profoundly crazy belief. And by crazy, I mean like groundbreaking, incredibly difficult to actually put into practice, right? Noble, beautiful. And I think that has to be understood when we contrast or juxtapose Malcolm X with Dr. King. I think that if you were to read Malcolm X's autobiography and what happened to him, and this is important because people need to understand why the Nation of Islam has to a certain extent and to a certain degree a hold in the black community. The Nation of Islam, at the time that Malcolm X was alive, was literally taking young black men who at this point, for example, in Harlem, were addicts, were junkies, and turning them into men of upstanding society,
mm-hmm.
right? And so in order to counter the toxic and deleterious effects of the Nation of Islam, we have to reckon and we have to be willing to accept and acknowledge that fact, right? The problem is that process of empowerment was also deeply rooted in a very toxic ideology, namely hating white people. And by hating white people, let me be very clear, because I feel like people don't know the extent to which the Nation of Islam is crazy when it comes to this issue.
Bring it.
The Nation of Islam believes that white people are actually like not fully evolved, like that they are actually subhuman, and that during the time...
Hey, you're talking to a termite over here.
Exactly,
so, you know.
Exactly. Like, yeah. But like actually. And that during the time of the, I don't know, what would you call it, messianic age, that like white people will be destroyed and people of color will take their proper place in the hierarchy of, I don't know, the great circle of life. So it's not just simply... Oh, you were very, like, people who were white were historically very harmful toward black people, and so that's why we don't like them. No. It's an entire, like ideology rooted in literally thinking white people are subhuman. And it's interesting because people will, on the one hand, like, in the same time, people will praise Malcolm X and praise the Nation of Islam without even recognizing that Malcolm X was killed by the Nation of Islam, had disavowed the Nation of Islam by the time he went to Mecca, right, and came back. And they're not willing to wrestle with the nuances of that particular movement seriously. But I say all that.
But
to
you
say,
recognize the power of that, obviously, right?
Sure.
The power of sort of just an easy answer.
Yes,
that just
that's yeah. what it is. It's easy. It's certain, right? And it's very difficult for people to live with uncertainty, which I think is something that the right needs to recognize and needs to grapple with when it is rightfully criticizing things like intersectionality,
mm-hmm.
right? There is an attraction in being certain, right? Because if you have to deal with uncertainty, if you have to accept uncertainty as a factor of life, that's very difficult. We have like fight or flight brains,
yeah.
right? We're not evolved to deal with uncertainty on some level or to be comfortable with uncertainty.
And yet it's almost the only certainty.
right.
Right?
Paradoxically.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But that I think also speaks to why intersectionality is so attractive, because it gives people a way to anchor their insecurities into something that is steadfast.
There's something to be said for sleeping like a baby, especially when you don't. You might have trouble falling asleep or waking up sore and achy or hot and sweaty. What would you do to sleep like a baby? Get the Purple mattress. It's totally comfortable and it stays nice and cool at night. It's different than anything you've ever felt before, and you'll get the best sleep you've ever had. If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you've got to try a Purple mattress. The Purple material feels very unique because it's both firm and soft at the same time, so it keeps everything supported while still feeling really comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. You're going to love Purple. And right now, my listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they're offering site-wide. Just text Ruben to 474747. It's the only way to get this free pillow, so text Ruben to 474747. That's R-U-B-I-N to 474747. Message and data rates apply, and now back to the show. So when you see people using some of the language that the intersectionalists or the woke crew buy into. So for example, a couple weeks ago, Jemele Hill, formerly of ESPN, now of The Atlantic,
yeah.
she tweeted out that Jordan Peterson's a white supremacist
right,
and a misogynist. So, and you know, it gets 20,000 retweets or something.
Right. Wasn't he just speaking to the Seattle Seahawks?
Yeah.
Okay, this is what I meant,
yeah,
by the way,
I
when I said mainstreamed. Like, that's awesome. Okay, continue. Sorry.
Yeah, but I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the genesis of the tweet.
Right.
Because it was about that Pete Carroll,
right,
the coach of the Seahawks, had
right,
let white supremacist
right,
and misogynist Jordan Peterson talk to the team. Then another
right,
ESPN guy picks it up, then she tweets it out.
Right.
So, of course, I just invited her. I said, you know what, I'm on tour with the guy.
Yeah.
You're
I
welcome
saw that.
To, yeah, I said,
I
you're welcome.
That.
I didn't even say you want to debate him, nothing. I just said, I would love to have you as a guest to the show.
Right.
And of course, she doesn't respond
right,
or anything.
Right.
But what do you make of the fact that they can lay those claims so easily and they're rewarded for it? So in other words, if you were to do this on the other side, if someone on the right was to say something, like if you call someone that's not a white supremacist a white supremacist, that's almost as damaging socially
right,
and politically and every other way as
right,
possible.
Right, right.
But if you were someone on the right and you said something that sounded off slightly racially,
mm-hmm,
you get called a racist, you get fired, and that's
I
it.
See.
But Jemele Hill, you
right,
know, she works it at the Atlantic, no
yeah,
problem, under David Frum, who sat in that very chair, and
right,
and I think Jeffrey Goldberg's the other guy, and it's
right,
like, you could say whatever you want. Now, again, you know my policy on free speech, so I'm not
right,
denying her ability to say it.
Right.
I'm just saying that the social capital. Yeah, exactly.
You're talking about social capital.
Yeah.
So what do I make of the social capital?
Yeah.
Is the
way that we can use it depending on
yeah,
these characteristics.
So I get what you're saying. I think it's true, but only to a certain extent. And I think that the fame and rise of Jordan Peterson proves that it's only true to a certain extent. Meaning, sure, from a social perspective, she has the freedom to make statements which are not completely thought out, which are pejorative in a way and disparaging in a way. Toward a person, and she can do so without, I mean, she obviously gets criticism, but she can do so without consequence, basically, on a certain level. But I would say that Jordan Peterson has a greater reach than she does. Jordan Peterson has a greater, I would say, growing fan base than she does. And so I would question who has the more social capital.
But is his social capital, or it's the capital of ideas? It's the capital of good ideas.
Sure.
Sort of.
Yeah, but I think that's the same thing.
Say, okay.
I think that his social capital is accruing greater interest, to continue with his metaphor, yeah, than hers is, and will continue.
Can you do an impression? Can you do a little of this? A little of this?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. The stocks are increasing.
Yeah.
and I think that will continue to play out. And I think that that actually speaks to the fact that the right is partially wrong when it talks about, at least within the context of Jordan Peterson, when it talks about the left's social capital. Because Jordan Peterson is pumping up the Seattle Seahawks, right? I don't know if he would consider himself to be right-wing, but I don't know if that's happened on the right in a very long time.
Yeah, I've been traveling with the guy for the last year, like 100 shows. I don't even know that he considers himself part of the right. I think
but
he's vaguely,
he's not,
right, because he's vaguely
he's
conservative, but
yeah.
I would say he's really an old school liberal
that's
been smacked around by reality.
But in a way, no, in all seriousness, he also transcends these labels.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's his power, and that's his social power. And that's what I meant when I said earlier, I get what he's doing, because
mm-hmm.
he is distilling things down to their essence. And regardless of how seemingly compelling the rhetoric of, I don't like this guy, Jordan Peterson, so I'm going to call him a white nationalist, goes far on Twitter, his distillation and breakdown of ideas and transforming those ideas into lessons to live your life by will almost inevitably always go farther. So I would disagree with the premise.
Yeah, all right, I'll take that. I like a little silver lining, you know what I mean? Like that, I will gladly take that. All right, so let's spend a little time on where you're doing most of your work now, which is advocacy for Israel. Now, one of the things that as a guy that voted Democrat my whole life, I can't really say I'm part of the left anymore, but a lefty my whole life until these last couple of years, I would say one of the things I'm most disappointed by the modern left is the just sort of unabandoned hatred of Israel.
Mm.
This 6 mile wide, absurdly tiny country with no natural resources, in the toughest neighborhood on earth, that's just trying to survive, basically.
But it
makes sense within the prism of everything else you've said here related to intersectionality.
Yeah.
They sort of don't like success. And Jews, so they like minorities, but they like minorities when they're oppressed.
Right.
Jews are now thought of as no longer oppressed, so you automatically put them in the oppressor category.
Right.
Now you've got a country of these people that have survived, and not only survived, but actually thrived.
Yeah.
Although there's Arab Muslim members of the Supreme Court and everything else, but no, they don't really care about that.
Right.
So I don't even know what my question is, other than like, what is that? Because it all, in some way, it all just boils down to that. They just hate this tiny little place that dares survive. Like, I sort of view it that way.
That's interesting. I think whenever you combine the two processes of caricaturing things, and I had another one. It's like when you caricature things, when you turn things into a caricature, and when you, well, we'll just go with that. If your fundamental philosophy, I think intersectionality is this, esteems caricaturing things, then inevitably, this is the other thing, caricaturing and conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
You put that together, you'll get anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And intersectionality.
I've seen the memes.
Yes. Yes. And intersectionality is a bit of a conspiracy theory. And it also caricatures people. And it caricatures communities. And it caricatures societies. And once you buy into that, I think that you will see, of course, Israel as this white colonialist oppressor. And Palestinians as this brown oppressed, right? Which is both a caricaturing and a conspiracy theorist. And in conspiracy theories, you caricature people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's sort of the process of how conspiracy theories work. You can't deal with depth or nuance or complexity. And so once this is your blueprint for understanding society, then you will gravitate toward anti-Semitism.
Someone needs to tell my brown Israeli brother-in-law that he's white.
Right. Well, this is the great irony. When you don't understand history and you also see everything through the prism of your own misunderstood when you understand everything or you see everything through the prism of your very small American lens, meaning these people grew up in America and they know that America's problems have historically been between black and white people, for example, until they think that everywhere else in the world, all of the conflicts that are going on are obviously also something to be divided along those racial lines.
Yeah.
It's ironically jingoistic on some level, or imperialistic, to use their term, to see everything through the lens and through the vantage point of your own reality, or historical reality, which is what they're projecting onto their understanding of Israel, Israeli society, not knowing, for example, that the majority of Jews in Israel are people of color, not knowing, just to really get down to details, that Likud party, which is Bibi's party, rose to power because of its taking on the challenges and the interests of the Mizrahi community, mm-hmm. In Israel, the Jews from North Africa, right? Yeah. There is no understanding of this reality because this reality cannot possibly exist within an intersectionalist view of society.
Yeah, so right? In that way, it becomes the perfect test case for their, I would say, basic struggle for what reality is, in a way, or something like that.
Well, struggle for reality, inability, again, to deal with depth. Like, I think that that's what this boils down to, ultimately, an inability to deal with nuance, an inability to deal with human complexity, the very complexity that they themselves have and possess. And that's a skill set to be able to do that, right? That's a virtue, I think, to be able to do that. And so it's not just the fact that these, to go back to students, are promoting something which is toxic and bad. It's also bad for them, right? Like, they're not going to have a healthy, holistic life if they are unable to deal with depth mm-hmm. and human complexity.
Do you think it has also something, I'm not totally sure about this, but something to do with just the geographic size of Israel, like the absurdly tiny nature of the borders, that you could literally drive both ways, up north, south, east, west, easily in a day. You could drive all the way north, all the way south, I'm sure in one day.
Yeah.
I think it's about 6-hour drive up north, down south. This way you could drive like, I don't know, 15 times in a day or something like that. But that it's so small that their focus on that can become like even more of a laser, even though they make it seem like it's just this monstrous, ever-growing blob or something like that.
I mean, I don't know, honestly. I haven't quite figured out the geographical piece to this. I don't know if it's relevant in their level of analysis. I think that...
Right, it's probably a little too high level or something.
Yeah. I don't think that really crosses their mind. I think just once you see the world through caricature and once you see yourself as living in this space where everyone's against you, then it's easy to fall into this trap of either anti-Semitism or coming very early close to anti-Semitism.
So what are some of the things that people say about you as you have fought this battle? Because, you know, look, I can look at some of my other friends and former guests that are black, that have taken unpopular positions related to the way black people are supposed to think, which is, of course, inherently racist.
Yeah.
But the things...
Racial essentialism, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the things that get said about Larry Elder, let's say, or Thomas Sowell for the last 50 years, or my friend David Webb, or plenty of other people. I know you get a certain percentage of that, because when I was doing a little Googling on you, people say not nice things about you.
Yeah, I mean, it could be that I just turned off my Twitter mentions, and so I don't...
Oh, you figured out the meaning of life.
So I don't really, like, come into contact with... I mean, honestly, if it is happening, I think I have a filter, and it is happening, right? But I think I have a filter, I have filters put into place and turned on that limit my seeing them. I hate to sound like callous, but I just don't care. Meaning, I think that, and it used to bother me. Like, in college, like, someone was very pejorative toward me. Someone was very racist toward me because of my, like, calling me, like, a slave and all of these various things. And there have been other, like I had a death threat in college.
I suspect this was a tolerant lefty saying that because of your views, right?
You know what? I don't want to caricature Dave, according to
But I'm talking about this
category.
Specific person. I think I'm
sure,
right.
Sure.
Yes.
I'm just saying, I don't want to caricature the left as this sort of like
I know, that was
monstrous.
Just a pretty, that's what we call an educated guess.
Fair. Yes, he himself particularly
yeah.
happened to belong to, yes. But what was I going to say? Oh, I had a death threat also in college, which was, it wasn't funny, but it, I don't know, it's kind of funny. That someone would take such time to like focus his energy on me, which is a little weird. But beside that, I just spend my time and my energy just trying to put out good things into the world. And I think that because I focus on that more than what the haters, so to speak, are saying, I just don't notice them anymore. And I'm just trying to put good energy out into the world.
To that end, you wrote your first piece in the New York Times, how long ago? About 5-6 months ago? Something like that?
Yes.
About that?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think in July or something.
Why I refuse to hate white people? Why, I want to get this right. Oh, I'm sorry. Why I refuse to avoid white people.
I'm glad you remembered.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you're supposed to remember the title to your first New York
Times.
Oh, okay. Oh, right. They get the title.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what do you make of that title then? Let's start that way, because a lot of people don't know that often you can write an op-ed for a major paper and that you don't pick the title. Because often people don't get past the title.
Right. I mean, I didn't have a problem with it. I think it was true to the essence of what I was saying.
So what was happening that I suspect it has a lot to do with everything we've talked about here, but what was going on that you thought that you had to write this? I mean, this should be pretty obvious stuff.
Right. I think there are actual pieces in the New York Times where other people of color were saying, like, I'm not going to have my child speak to white people. And I was like, what?
There was one. I mean, you're not making this up. There was one just a little bit before that literally was saying
literally said that. Yeah. And I think that I was also having this intellectual fight within myself against Ta-Nehisi Coates and sort of everything he stands for. And, like, I have a very strong reaction to that. And I think that this piece was the product of all of those things and a response to all of those things. And the gist of it was just that I grew up around all types of people, white people, black people, Muslims, Asians. Like, I went to a very egalitarian high school, extremely egalitarian. So the process by which people, again, caricature each other and caricature white people is something that is a very foreign thing to me. Like, I can't quite wrap my head around that sort of language that's used by people who believe in intersectionality. And quite frankly, by people who probably have good intent. Like, I'm sure the guy who wrote that piece about having his child avoid white people was coming from a place of a genuine and a sincere place of concern. So I don't want to, like, disparage him in any way, but I just don't think...
You would say his answers are confused.
His intent, okay. Yeah, exactly. But perhaps I would say that his fear was probably real, right? And so I think that there's just a better way and a more healthier way of going about these things.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think Martin Luther King would think about our society right now? There's a good one for you.
Did you read my tweet yesterday?
I saw your tweet. Tell the good people your tweet.
I said I was preparing for taping, and I was doing so by watching Dr. King speeches. That's so funny.
Well,
you're good at your job.
I'm all right. I'm all right. Well, what do you think he would think of things these days? The state of the way we talk about race, the people that I think they're his natural allies are often using arguments that are what I would say are 180 degrees the reverse of what his arguments were.
Yeah. Dr. King...
I know this is almost an impossible question at some level. So,
I mean, Dr. King wrote a book called Strength to Love, which is a collection of his sermons. And I think in one of the first or second like sermon/essays, he talks about like why he rooted his nonviolent movement in this belief in concept of love or agape love for love's sake, essentially. And I think that given the fact that he wrote that, I think that he would definitely eschew this new impulse within society to reduce each other to immutable characteristics. I mean, this is what he was fighting against, right? But, or I should say, and, right, he would also have devised a rhetoric that was strong enough and compelling enough to inspire people to aspire to loving each other. And I think that's actually what's missing.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from a few different commentators here and there who might be, who sort of exist in the, I think, the TED Talk circuit,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's this movement within America trying to teach people how to love. And I think that that's something we've lost. And that was something that was very central to Dr. King's writings and Dr. King's work. Again, as I said earlier, to devise a blueprint where you say, I am not going to fight back against this white person, not just because nonviolence is a very strategic tactic, but because this man was made in the image of God. Like, that is existential. And there is no profoundly existential movement rooted in love in the same way that it was when he devised it in the 60s.
Is that partly because we've just made everything political?
Yes. Yes, I mean, it's become like our identity, right? Which is, by the way, why I'm just like, when you say like the left and the right, like, I don't know, these categories have to a certain extent lost meaning for me.
And I say that all the time, and I think you can even, when I'm saying them, there's a certain exhaustion with them. Because sometimes you just have to frame, we just need words. You know, it's funny, you said we've sort of lost the language to talk about some of this stuff. Sometimes you just need some labels loosely to talk about these things. Otherwise,
the people who can handle complexity and the people who cannot handle complexity.
I'll go with that, but can you give me something snappier? Can we get words to make that a little snappier? Can you get that in one bumper sticker? But that really is what it is. I mean, that also explains the explosion of these conversations online.
Right.
Because we're not getting them through mainstream media.
You know what I would say? I would say friends and potential friends.
I told you we were going to end this with love. Do you have anything else in the love department?
I think you
nailed it there. And then I want to talk about your website real quick.
Oh, I was going to talk about that.
Let's roll them together into that. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the reasons why there are negative conversations being had about various topics, various political topics on college campuses and even in our political discourse in general, is because of the framework in which that conversation is had. That framework we've talked about is intersectionality to a certain extent. Intersectionality essentially encourages people to make assumptions about each other, whether it's assumptions based upon skin color, based upon financial status or lack thereof, based upon gender, etc. So in order to challenge the conversation or change the conversation, you have to challenge the framework. And the framework that challenges intersectionality is the theory of enchantment.
And somebody here has a website called theoryofenchantment.com. What the hell's going on over there?
So a little bit of context. I was at the Wall Street Journal for a year. 2015, I was mentored by Brett Stevens. And part of my assignment was to develop a paper. And in this paper, I was essentially trying to figure out what the psychology of connection was. Why do people gravitate toward what they gravitate toward? And if I can figure out the psychology of connection or the science of connection, then can I use that science of connection to heal disconnection? And that is what ended up being the theory of enchantment. And the theory of enchantment depends heavily upon pop culture, studying pop culture, because pop culture shows us what we gravitate toward. So I began to ask myself questions during the course of writing this research paper, like, why do we gravitate toward companies like Nike? What is it?
You love Nike.
Love it. Love Nike. But like for some people, Nike is a religion. Like, it's like on that level. And like, why do we gravitate towards singer-songwriters and influencers like Beyoncé? And people would say, well, it's Beyoncé. It's very obvious, Chloe. It's Beyoncé. But I'm like, no, it's not obvious. There's something happening there. And it turns out that all of these influencers and all of these companies, etc., are doing one simple thing. They're creating content where their audience sees themselves and their potential reflected in the content. And that's how they're generating connection. So you wear that Nike shoe because you think to yourself, if I wear this Nike shoe, I'll be able to just do it, right? As the slogan goes. When Beyonce says, who run the world, girls, women see themselves and their potential reflected in that song, which is why they gravitate toward her. So how do we use that basic idea to bring together people who have been disconnected? So the theory of enchantment has three principles of trying to bring connection in previously polarized spaces. And this can be used in interpersonal conflict or conflicts of other natures. So the first rule is to remember that we are human beings and not political abstractions. Because the first thing that happens in these spaces is we abstract about each other. We think that we're talking to political objects or entities and not a full person. And what I will do in a presentation is that I will point to a pop culture reference that illustrates this. And I usually point to Kendrick Lamar, because Kendrick Lamar has a song called DNA. And he says in this song, "I got power, poison, pain, and joy inside my DNA." And what he's doing when he says that is he is articulating and illustrating what it means to be a human being. We have all of these things mm-hmm. within us. We have the capacity to do good. We have the capacity to destroy. We have the capacity to build up, right? And we have the capacity to tear down. And just as this impulse exists within the person who I disagree with, who I'm having a problem with, it also exists within me, right? And realizing this is sort of the beginning, I think, for empathy and mutual understanding. So that's the first rule. Remember, we are human beings, not political abstractions. And as a corollary, we will not dehumanize or stereotype or objectify any of the human beings or any of the communities involved in this conflict, whatever that conflict is. The second principle is, if you want to criticize, criticize in order to uplift and empower, never to tear down, never to destroy. So if that person who believes in intersectionality is being very mean to me and aggressive to me, I could criticize him by cursing him out, right?
And you can do that.
By speaking down to him, or I can criticize him in a way that makes it very clear that I actually believe in his potential, and I actually believe that he's better than the content or the rhetoric, the empty rhetoric that he's putting out. And by speaking in the manner that suggests that, I'm more likely to change him. So, quick story: Maya Angelou told this story about how she was on set with Tupac at a movie set. And Tupac was in the corner somewhere cursing out this guy who he didn't like, and they were like about to get into a fight. And then Maya Angelou says, come here, let me talk to you. And he's Tupac, so he's like still mumbling under his breath. And then she says, come over here, let me talk to you. And then she tells him, don't you know that we are counting on you? Don't you know that you are the next generation and that we're looking toward you to pave the way for us? Don't you know that you have been loved? And we're looking toward you as the next person to uphold us. And so the story goes that in that moment, Tupac starts crying. Because she had rooted her criticism in her fundamental belief in him. Mm-hmm. You know? And mm-hmm. then the next day, he's still being aggressive toward that guy. And then Maya passes and he straightens up and he goes, good morning, Miss Angela. Right? So he changes, he modifies his behavior in front of someone because she believes in him. So that's the second. And then the third and final principle is everything we do, we try to root in love and compassion. Which sounds very vague. But what it means is if someone is being aggressive towards you or mean towards you or whatever, you call that out as inappropriate. You say, I don't know you from Adam. I don't know why you're prejudging me, which is the definition of prejudice, right? But what I'm not going to do is I'm not going to prejudge you, even though you have prejudged me. Instead, if you want, let's go to this coffee shop and let's actually talk about this topic X, topic Y, whatever we're having a disagreement over. Because what's happening in that moment is they're probably seeing you as a political abstraction, not as a full human being. And you have to rehumanize that space. And the purpose, by the way, is not to get that person to agree with every single viewpoint you have. The purpose of that is to bring back compassion and empathy, even in the midst of profound disagreement, which is something we are not doing so well here. In America. So that's the theory of enchantment.
This has been a pleasure. Can you run for president or something?
No, absolutely not.
That would not work with any of those three pillars.
No, it would. I prefer pop culture to political culture.
Yeah.
That's the honest truth. Yeah. But I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm so glad we finally did this, and
likewise,
we will do it again for sure. Awesome. And for more on Chloe, you can check out theoryofenchantment.com.